Yes, that's right. Terry came up with the idea at Jimmy's funeral, actually. He sort of saw the love and the respect that everybody had for Jimmy. You know, he was a bit of a national treasure, really. And it really kind of choked him up. He's quite an emotional guy, Terry. And he thought it'd be a good idea to get a book done. And he knew I was a big Jimmy Greaves fan and was approached me. So I'm absolutely delighted because Jimmy was my absolute hero and still is as a footballer, and as a person, really.
Because he's Jimmy had brought out autobiographies. There were biographies about him. So the idea behind this book, it feels, was very much just people's memories of him. And the sort of format is very much each chapter is a particular person sharing their memories of Jimmy.
Yeah, I think that's what makes it unique, really, because I mean, as you said, there's been loads of books on Jimmy Greaves, and you know, his football career and has been dissected to more than a few times. And I think that this is just a lovely, simple format, you know, and I think you can get really to the heart of Jimmy Greaves. You know, that's the idea of it. It obviously we spoke about his football, but a lot of it was about Jimmy Greaves, the man. And I mean, it was quite an emotional kind of thing, really. You know, particularly speaking to his family. I mean, they were so open, and I think in a way, it was a part of their grieving process because he only died last September. And so, when I was speaking to them, it must have been really quite hot, quite a difficult time for them. So. So that I think that's it is a kind of good idea. You know, it's a good idea, and it all depends on how people react to you. And I like to try and be personable and sensitive to the situation. And I think hopefully I've got the best out of people.
Yes, as you say, you separated it into his private life, I guess, and his public life. So speaking to a lot of his family, his nearest and dearest, and I was going to ask you exactly that, how maybe tough it was to speak to them not long after they'd lost him, or if they were sort of quite happy to share those memories with you.
Yes, well, you know, I mean, I like to, as I said to you earlier, I like to think I'm sort of a sensitive person, and I lost my mum a couple of years ago. I know what, I mean, we've all had losses, and I kind of was very sensitive to that. So I like to think that it came across. You know, I try and treat people with respect and realize what they're going through. And I didn't know how they would react. I mean, even if I was being sensitive, I didn't know that they would react positively. But they were great, you know, and they really kind of put their heart on their sleeves. And it was absolutely absolute privilege and an honor to speak to them all, and particularly the family. The family were wonderful, you know, and a credit to Jimmy himself. You know, he always said his greatest achievement was his family. You know, forget the football, forget the television career and theatre career. His family was his main source of pride.
Because I get from the family chapters, I think starting with his wife, that she says he was quite a private man who just became this public figure.
Yes, he was. Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, he just went along with it because he was quite an easygoing guy. He just went along with it, and he wasn't. Yeah, he wasn't. He'd be quite happy in his own company watching the cricket on the telly, you know. But if somebody said to him, like his agent Terry Baker, "Oh, look, I've got this job for you," he would quite happily go along and mix with people. And he was, you know, he was very, very. I mean, from what I was told, Mitzi, I think his daughter said how he loved to hug people. You know, he would meet people and give them a big hug and make them feel welcome. And he just had this easy way about him. I mean, he was a private man, and he kind of very much a bit of a nonconformist, really. He went his own way, did his own thing. But if people approached him, he was quite happy to go along with things. He was quite easygoing about it.
I think I spoke to his son, Danny. Sadly, Jimmy had suffered his stroke by then, but there was the campaign at that point to get him knighted. Do you think the family felt that Jimmy got the recognition he deserved?
Well, if you've spoken to Danny, you'll know precisely the answer. He certainly, Danny felt it was a huge omission for him, not for Jimmy, not to get knighted. And I don't know Jimmy as well. I mean, I met him a few times and a lovely bloke, but I didn't know how he would particularly respond to that. I should imagine he couldn't be bothered with the fuss, you know. But Danny and all the family just think he deserved it, because I mean he served the nation, really. He was a national treasure for, you know, since, well, the late 50s. I mean, he scored 114 goals as a junior in one season for Chelsea, and then from then on, and then his football career is well documented, and Saint and Greasy and everything. And then he went on to, he was a hit everywhere. Everything he did, he was successful at, and he was a complete natural at. It wasn't kind of something he had to work too hard on. And it all came across, you know.
You met him a couple of times, but you met him, you must have been a little bit starstruck, because you are a Tottenham fan. And I sense that a lot of your most treasured Tottenham memories are special moments that he gave the club.
Oh, absolutely. I'm getting tearful now even thinking about it. My dad took me along. I saw him play 61 when he joined Spurs, and he provided magic moments, unforgettable moments. The atmosphere is electric. When he got the ball, the whole stadium lit up. I mean, it was absolute electricity running right through the stadium. I know there was some electricity yesterday with the wrong result for Spurs, without being there. I mean, everybody who was there would say the same thing. And I think that, you know, I saw him play when they beat Liverpool 7-2, would you believe? He scored four goals. And I remember I was standing there with my dad at the Park Lane end, and we were surrounded by Liverpool supporters. And my dad was looking very edgy, you know, thinking I might sort of do the wrong thing. And yet, despite him scoring four goals and Spurs absolutely trouncing Bill Shankly's Liverpool, we both escaped, and the Liverpool fans were absolutely lovely and very friendly. I mean, I could go on and on about my memories of Jimmy Greer. I saw him miss a penalty once, and was hanging on to on the east stand, the shelf, as they call it, and I was hanging on to this edge of the shelf, and it was so crowded. It was against West Ham, and I had to turn around to see the game, and I saw Jimmy balloon the ball over the bar from the penalty spot, which is like a very rare event. I mean, he was incredibly, such a natural at it. You know, he was known for his little tap-ins. It was just his timing. I mean, if you go on YouTube and watch some of his old clips, and the way he beat people, you know, with the faintest little feints here and there. And as soon as he got the ball, you thought, right, we're going to score here. You know, he's one of those players. You thought, he's going to score. And I mean, he scored 266 goals, I think, for Spurs, 357 goals in the Premier Division of the Football League, it was a European record until I think Ronaldo broke it a couple of years ago. I mean, that's, and he did that in the mid 60s, and by 1970. And it's kind of, his goal scoring, it's just indescribable. I mean, to me, because of obviously my generation, he's got to be the best goal scorer there ever was. I mean, people talk about Messi, and you can say he's got more goals. But look at the, you know, it's the old cliche, but look at the pitches that Greaves played on. Look at, you had the likes of Ron Harris, you had Chopper, you know, Chopper, and you had, I interviewed, actually, a lovely, lovely chap, and Norman Hunter and Billy Brennan, all these guys, you know, absolute animals of footballers. And then you had these pitches, you can't believe what the pitches were like, you know. Nowadays, if Jimmy, I know, again, it's a cliche, but if you look at pitches today, Jimmy Greaves would have probably doubled his total of goals, you know, and his goal scoring is incredible. I mean, he almost got a goal a game for 10 years. I mean, he was top goal scorer for 6 years in the Premier League. Mm. I mean, it's just, you know, it defies belief, really. And you know, and I'm obviously biased, but he was just wonderful.
You spoke to some of his teammates, some of the people he played against, and the common opinion was that he was ridiculously naturally talented.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, we're talking about people at top football. I mean, well, Jeff Hurst, you know, who the whole World Cup story, but I mean, he was, you know, he scored a hat trick in a World Cup final. We had, I mean, Glenn Hoddle, probably one of the finest players England produced and was totally underused in my book, but then I would say that. I mean, Cliff Jones, you know, thought he was the greatest goal scorer of all time. I mean, and he was a legend. I mean, it's sort of legends talking about this man, and they're saying, you know, I mean, Jeff Hurst is well above me, and Glenn Hoddle said he was, as you know, an England manager for the 1998 World Cup. And he said he'd pick if he had Greaves available, he'd pick him above everybody. He's better than Shearer, better than Owen, better than whoever. And so, I mean, if you've got people like that talking about him in those kind of terms, you know, it's like a legend's legend kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff Hurst obviously famously played in a World Cup final that Jimmy didn't play in. But I think he suggested to you that maybe Jimmy was so laid back, so nice, that maybe he didn't express his how upset he was about that at the time, didn't show how upset he was about what happened in 1966, even though he accepts that it was the right decision based on the outcome of that final, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Jimmy had a big sense of perspective, because he lost his first son, Jimmy Jr., after a few months. So what he said was, in comparison to that, missing out on the World Cup final is nothing. But having said that, it must have hurt. But Jeff made a very good point, actually. He said that they didn't talk about things. I said, did Jimmy talk about his injury and missing it? And he said they never spoke about it. Injuries were all part and parcel of it, you know. It was like Irene told me about their son. He said when they lost their first son, it wasn't a big deal. He just got on with it. It was kind of like that kind of attitude. There was no counselling or anything. And I think with Jimmy, yeah, he was a laid back character, but I think he hid his hurt. You know, I mean, he didn't want to go to the party, World Cup final party, because he didn't want to be a party pooper, you know, because he was feeling a bit down, went straight on holiday with his family. So I think he hid it, but it wasn't the end of the world for him, because, as I told you, you know, about what happened with his first son. So he kind of had that perspective on it.
I think I picked out a few stories from the book. Is it Phil Beale talking about scoring for Tottenham against Queen's Park Rangers? And I think Jimmy passed him the ball rather than scoring himself. And Phil asked him afterwards why he'd done that. Mm. And why had he done that?
He'd done that because there was no cameras. Yeah. I mean, that was brilliant. I mean, Phil Beale, he said to me that he never sort of ventured beyond the halfway line normally. And then when he was in a rarefied atmosphere when he was kind of went over the halfway line, and hang on a minute, I've still got the ball. And he couldn't believe it. And he kind of, Jimmy gave it back to him. And as you just said, that, you know, he asked you in training during the week, why didn't you give the ball back to me? He said, oh, well, there's no cameras here, so I thought I'd let you have a bit of the glory, you know. It's great, you know. And this is the only goal that Phil Beale ever scored in about 500 matches for Spurs, you know, and it's all thanks to Jimmy Greaves.
Mm, and I think there was another story, I mean, talking about the World Cup final, but was it Mike England who basically said that Jimmy always expected to play in big games? He always expected to be in FA Cup finals, so it didn't faze him.
No, that's right. That's right. I mean, he was pretty nerveless, really, you know. I mean, from what people tell me, he had this calm calm authority when he was kind of in the penalty area. It wasn't panic stations, you know, it was kind of, he was just cool, calm and collected. And it's exactly what you need in a goal scorer. If, you know, if you've got somebody in the box, you know, who's like that, who's keeping their cool, it's great. I mean, there was, I think Terry Baker told me the story about how, I mean, years later, you know, I did well retired and, you know, watching a game and some guy kind of, somebody had approached Jimmy to write a book on how to score goals or something. And then Jimmy turned it down because he said, well, I don't know how I score goals. I can just do it. You know, it's just a natural thing. And then this poor guy had a chance and missed it. And Jimmy goes, oh God, you know. And I think he should have kept his cool. Yeah. But it's easy saying that. I mean, he had this just such, it was such a natural, you know, he was such a natural at it that it kind of, he didn't even think it, he sort of, in a way, he didn't really appreciate how good he was himself, you know, because of this natural ability. And whereas everybody's jaws were dropping on the floor, and he was just, and I mean, he, as he said, he largely through alcohol, I think, but he said he doesn't remember a lot of his goals, but he certainly provided me with life affirming moments. I mean, without question, you know, and I'm not alone.
Yeah. I, you mentioned alcohol and I wondered if anybody spoke to you about the battles that he had with drink, because I think Barry Fry talks about it a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, well, that most of them did. Yeah. I mean, Barry Fry was saying that he never sort of saw him drink really. He said he came on the bar, he was playing for Barnet, and this is when Jimmy was kind of trying to make a comeback, comeback of sort of just keep himself away from the booze, I think. And he used to sit on the front of the coach while all the lads on the coach were having a drink, and he was keeping out of it. And he never showed Barry Fry or any of the Barnet people that he was a drinker. But I mean, it's really what happened. Before that was his oldest friend, Dave Emmerich, a lovely, lovely guy. They knew each other since they were 7 years old, playing over the hockey pitches at Hainault. And he was his best. They were both each other's best man. And he was told by Jimmy and by Irene that he helped rescue Jimmy from his, because he offered him a chance to play for his team. He was a manager of Brentwood Town in the Essex League. And he thought, well, why not? I'll ask Jimmy Greaves if he wants to play for me. Almost like half expected him. Yeah, I mean, and bear in mind, Jimmy Greaves retired from professional football at age 31. So he wasn't a great age, you know. But he said, he said, look, I can't give any money. I'll go give a fiver a week or something. I got, you know, and Jimmy goes, yeah, all right, I'll do it. And he reckons that sort of got him sort of back on track. I mean, he's still drinking, but it got excited to the slow process of him getting well again and joining Alcoholics Anonymous and forgoing the drink for over half his life, to be honest. I mean, it was about 40 years or something. He was on the wagon.
If we think we know everything there is to know about Jimmy Greaves, I'm sure this book must share a few things that perhaps we didn't know before.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of it is you know, I mean, I don't know if everybody knew how devoted a family man he was. You know, I think, you know, a lot is said about his football and his public face, but I mean, to be honest, I think it's only Danny who's got a bit of a profile publicly. I mean, all the others keep very much in the background. That's why I was so honoured that they actually chose to speak to me. So I guess I'm not sure if I was surprised that he was a good family man. I just didn't know the details of it all. You know, I didn't know Lynn, his eldest daughter, sort of absolutely worships him. I mean, even now, she said that they took a film of her daughter's wedding, and Jimmy was the best man at the wedding, and she can't bring herself to look at it. I mean, she's got all the piles of newspapers from when he died, and they're tucked neatly under the bed, and she can't look at them. There's a greasy television documentary, which I think Terry Baker was involved in, BT Sports, and that she's never looked at that. So it's like, I mean, she was sort of, in many ways, sort of was at the brunt when he was an alcoholic. I mean, she was about 18, I think. She didn't make a big thing of this, by the way, and she didn't want to, and I didn't want to force her into it, but she did mention that when they took him into Worley Psychiatric Hospital to dry out, basically, I mean, she was the one that escorted him there, and when he came out, he went into a pub, had a quick drink, and then couldn't get to the bar, and that's when he made his decision. That was it, you know. I mean, he told Irene that was it, and he never, you know, touched a drop after that. But I haven't really answered your question, but it's a hard one to, you know, to pinpoint, because there's so many stories. I mean, one story that did surprise me, actually. There was Brian Doherty, who put the family, very close friend of Jimmy's. They used to go golfing, him, Danny, Andy, the younger son. They used to go on these golfing trips, and they went off to Latuque once. And he said that Jimmy was an okay golfer, wasn't fantastic, but they used to have a great crack. And he was lining up. Jimmy was having a great round, and I think he'd never broken 80. I'm not a golfer, so excuse me if I get these things wrong. But he said look, I've played in front of 100,000 at Wembley, played in the World Cup finals. I mean, but I was really nervous about this shot, because if he'd have made this shot, he would have broken his best record for a golf course. And as Doc said, you know, look, it was only four of us playing around the golf, and he was more nervous about that than he was playing in front of 100,000 at Wembley. You know, incredible. You know, it's kind of incredible.
Clearly, not as good a golfer as he was a footballer. Some of the people in the book sort of liken him to Messi, you know, suggest that he would be a star today. Where would he fit, do you think, into a Tottenham team of today, an England team of today?
Well, I think I sort of answered it earlier, really, in a way, because I mean, if I'd say he's the best goal scorer of all time, that covers a lot of ground. But and it's really, as I said to you, going back to the state of the pitches and everything, and the balls were like you know, medicine balls, you know, in comparison to what they play with today. So, Messi, I mean, in style, I guess he's comparable to Messi, you know, the way Messi weaves through people. I don't know how good he is at the moment. He had that natural ability to do that. But Messi's, bear in mind, played on these fantastic pitches. I mean, Ronaldo, I mean, they're all fantastic players, technically fantastic players. And, you know, they probably would have done okay on those boggy pitches. But there's no way of knowing that. I mean, it's why, in a way, it's hard to compare eras, you know, well, impossible, really. But all I can do is surmise that Jimmy would have blown away any opposition to the title of the greatest goal scorer, because the amount of goals he got, you know, as I said to you, 357 goals in about 516 league games, I think. I mean, it's they go bang on about Shearer's Premier League record. I think that's 260 or something. I mean, you know, 260, you know, and Greaves got, you know, over 100 more, you know, or 100 more. And it's kind of, you put him up against any goal scorer in my experience, and he would come out on top in my view.
You finished the book, or towards the end of the book, there's just a little paragraph from him in which he sort of sums himself up as I think Just Some Sort of Man. Did you reach the same conclusion that he did about himself?
I mean, he was just a normal bloke, you know. You know, he was. I mean, Danny was saying, you know, I said, how would you sum up your dad? And he said he was kind, generous, and supportive. And he was just a natural guy, you know. He would give away stuff. You know, he gave away nearly all his caps. He was just a, you know, a nice, as I said to you, a nice, easygoing guy. I mean, he might have this God-given talent, but it sort of didn't go to his head by any means, you know. And that's how I met him a couple of times. Lovely, charming, you know, just great company, and obviously a great wit, you know. I mean, and very intelligent. I mean, his sister Marion, again, I mean, these are people I'd never seen quoted in the press before, you know, his family. And Marion was, I said, well, what would you like emphasised most about your brother? And she said, well, everybody talks about his football and everything. It says, but I think it's his intelligence, you know. And he was a very intelligent guy. And I think Marion went to university. I think Jimmy's younger brother went to university, but he chose football. But he could have gone on to university, and who knows, you know. That was quite illuminating, you know. I think it was the era that he was brought up in, just, you know, the war, during the war, playing football over the pitches in the war, during the war, and being football crazy, you know. And the opportunities, I don't think, were open to him. There wasn't really a pathway to university for him at that time. But he, as Marion said, he would probably have chosen football anyway.
Good job as well.
Yeah. Good job for us all.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, I wouldn't have the memories I've got. I mean, you know, this sounds a bit over the top, but I really treasure those memories, you know. I mean, we've all got our special moments in life, you know, and then, you know, cliche, but life is built on a lot of memories, really. You kind of like, you know, you were there at a certain time when something happened, and I was there for 10 years watching Jimmy Greaves score millions of goals, you know, and giving me the thrills, you know, compared to anything else that I've experienced in my life, really, you know. So there you are.
So I think it feels as if this book shares that view, that it was a privilege to know him, and it was a privilege to watch him play.
It certainly was. I mean, if you can indulge me for a second, there's a poem in the book. I don't know if you've seen that, but I'll just read you a couple of lines from it. This poem is called Jimmy Greaves, and it was written on the day he died, and that's the day that Spurs played Chelsea, these two old teams, and we won't talk about the result either. I'll just start a few lines. It says, "I have stopped all Auden's clocks. He is dead. I explained that the morning rain was the tears of a million old men mourning his passing and their distant youth." And that's just beautiful. And it's my friend Kevin Rogers, actually, who's a big, big Jimmy Greaves fan. But I thought he captured that, because that's how I felt, you know, going to that Spurs-Chelsea game. You know, it's on the very day he died, you know. It was very touching, very touching.